On today's Talk Zone Newsmaker interview, a legendary inventor, a brilliant creative mind, and the co-founder of Apple Computers, we'll meet Steve Wozniak, who went from geek to chic.
Now, your New York Times bestseller is I Was, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon. It's now in paperback. One review said, this book takes us inside the mind of the ultimate nerd, which I guess you would consider that a compliment, right?
Well, I was a typical nerd. I don't know if I was the ultimate nerd, because especially, you know, the guys who were into the geeky things and talk the geeky talk, I think I was one step away. I mean, back then that was my life, but I know ones now that would scare me.
You just kind of had this theme all through your book, is that a lot of your creativity stemmed from having fun, and you had a lot of fun along the way. Do you think fun is part of the creative process for you?
For me, yes. I don't know if it's for everyone, but I think it might apply to a lot of people. But to me, I just always, everything I had done in my life with electronics, it was strange and different. Building little devices, often they didn't have any value, like they were worth starting a company, but they were fun to do. So I just started saying, you know, whatever you do, that's your lifetime passion, your work, if you build a little fun in, you just have a better life. You know, hey, go to work and work alongside others, but if you can just have the release of joking and talking nicely with people, I mean, that's, you know, we all do that.
Yeah, and there are some very funny stories, and we'll ask you to share a couple of those in a minute, but just to start at the beginning, Steve, you've said in your book your biggest influence was your dad, and he sounds like he was an interesting guy. Could you tell us a little about him?
Yeah, he was more than an influence, a mentor too, and he didn't really push me in a direction saying, you should go in mathematics, you should go in computers. Never did that. I was the only engineer out of our family, out of the kids. Whenever I had something I liked to do, he helped teach me more to do a better job on science fair projects and the like. And he was there. He did, you know, he was an engineer. I watched him work. I went down to his place of work and saw him hook wires up and get signals on an oscilloscope. And I thought, wow, this is what you do when you grow up. And I decided at a very early age I wanted to be an engineer like he. And electronics, you know, was kind of fun because you always built little projects. And if you're shy, other people in the school didn't know how to build things, so it kind of gave you a little, you know, a little higher elevation in your own mind.
Sure, it gave you a little social status, I guess.
Not among them. I think just internally to yourself, you knew that, wow, you've got this little specialness, and they don't, and they don't have to know it. Once in a while, you'd build something, show it off, or, you know, take, you know, they'd know you're a ham radio operator, but they wouldn't know. You might not even understand yourself when you're very young, you know, what it's all worth.
And about what age was all this happening for you?
Wow. An awful lot of it was happening in elementary school. Some important steps were happening in middle school. In high school, boy, I was very, very lucky to stumble in the direction of my internal passion, which was computers. I just stumbled on a good teacher who got me involved with working in industry, programming computers on my own, learning what real computers were like, and then trying on my own to design them using my skills way back to elementary school.
Around 1975, which is, I guess, ancient history in the computer world, you got involved with a group called the Homebrew Computer Club. What were they up to?
It was actually 1975, and I stumbled into it by accident. I was too shy to ever raise my hand at anything, but whenever I did something good, like got a great score on a test in school, you know, people would talk to me, and I liked that. Whenever I designed something really good, people would talk to me, and I had just designed a method of communicating with computers on the early ARPANET, which was the early stages of today's Internet, and I could communicate with about 12 computers that were all linked together with a device that I built myself. It had a keyboard, and it had my television set to see what the computer was typing back, and the computer could be across the country or across the world. So I thought, I'll go down to this new club I heard about and show off my skills and show off my little design for a terminal and show other people how to build their own. You know, I came from the hobbyist magazine community where you see projects and it says, here's a project that you could build yourself very inexpensively. I wanted to be one of those guys just helping other people who wanted to build their own. And when I got down there, they were all talking about computers based on microprocessors finally being affordable, and that was my life dream. So I went every 2 weeks of my life, every Wednesday, every other Wednesday, we met Stanford Linear Accelerator Auditorium, and it was the most amazing time of my life. You just felt that you were on top of a revolution that was happening. The world was changing. A bunch of technical geeks and, you know, low-level people on the world social scale were talking this talk about how they were going to change the world and become more important than the CEOs, and the big companies were putting us down. My God, that was thrilling.
Yeah, and of course that happened to some extent. Our guest is Steve Wozniak, author of I Was, Computer Geek to Cult Icon. Steve, in the chapter in your book, Cream Soda Days, you talk about the cream soda computer. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, I had designed a lot of computers in high school. I could never afford the parts to build them. Between my second and third year of college, I took 1 year off to work to earn the money for my third year of college. And while working, I told the executives how I designed all these computers in high school. I could never get the parts, and they said they would get me the parts. So I designed a computer real quickly, and they got me a bunch of chips, and I designed it and soldered them together down the street with a friend, and we called it the cream soda computer because Bill Fernandes and I would ride our bikes down to the Safeway store, get some cream soda. You'd have to ride through orchards in those days.
Oh, wow.
It was, you know, not Silicon Valley. In 1970, it was still Santa Clara Valley, and we'd ride down on our bikes, get cream soda, and drink it. That's what we drank.
And
so that was our cream soda computer, and he was the one that introduced me to Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you met another important Steve through that computer. What was your first impression of him?
Well, we both had an amazing thing in common, which is nobody knew digital chips, what they were and what they were about and what you could make with them, except for Steve and I. Almost no one in our high school knew that sort of stuff, and we also shared a lot of other interests in jokes, humor, pranks, the sorts of things engineers do, even music, philosophies of life. He was more of a true living the counterculture, and I was more just admiring it, but, you know, pretty centered in life.
And we haven't really talked about any of the fun stuff you were doing, but you created a dial-a-joke service at some point here. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'm so proud of that. I was a young engineer at Hewlett-Packard, 1972, and I believed so much in humor. And I knew that there were machines in some countries of the world where you could dial a phone number and hear a joke. And I wanted to do it, so I set up the very first one ever in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it sounds very simple. Just get an answering machine. But in 1972, it was illegal in the United States to own, use, or operate your own telephone. It was illegal to own, use, or operate your own answering machine.
Huh, wow.
I had to rent this extremely expensive machine that cost as much as an apartment rental from the local phone company. And that's why, you know, as a young engineer, you know, I had 3 years of college and just a starting engineering job. That's an awful lot to rent your apartment and then pay the same amount again for an answering machine. But I really believed in what I was doing and had a great time.
The volume of calls on that just kept going up and going up, right?
There was 2,000 calls a day on a single-line number. This wasn't like, you know, several lines could answer at once. Only one could. And I'm pretty sure it was the highest called number in the United States for a single-line number like that.
Also, we're jumping around here a little bit, but you were into something called phone phreaking back before the phone company wised up to it. Was a way to make free phone calls, free long-distance phone calls. Just for our listeners who don't know what that is, explain that.
In 1971, 1972, I was a student at Berkeley, and I discovered through a couple of articles that were going around in the Sunday newspaper supplements and Esquire magazine that this group of engineers professing to be outsmarter than the phone company engineers had discovered flaws in the phone system that let you put little tones into a telephone and dial calls through undersea cables and overseas over-the-air satellites to any country in the world. And it was just like an amazing adventure. Who could believe it? And it was like fiction. And I checked it out with Steve Jobs, and unfortunately we discovered it wasn't fiction. It was true. It was possible. The phone company had these huge lapses, and we became phone freaks, and I did it just for to be part of this amazing adventure that nobody would know even existed. Not to make free phone calls. I would even make sure that I paid for my own phone calls.
And tell us the story about the Pope involving this.
Well, every once in a while, it was a chance for me, a shy kid, even then, to be a master of ceremonies, talking about how this phone freaking worked and how these very strange people like myself and weird engineers operated networks that they set up of their own, and I would do little jokes. So I would call other countries, a restaurant or a hotel in another country, and one day I got the idea of calling the Pope. So I called him and said I was Henry Kissinger, and they had me call back an hour later, and I got up to speaking to the bishop who was going to be the translator for the Pope.
and
he said I wasn't Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, well, I imagine you could have gotten in trouble for that, but we're glad you didn't.
But back then they didn't have caller ID and all that, and I gave them a number to call me back in the United States anyway.
Moving along, you worked at Hewlett-Packard for a number of years, and you did some exciting things there. Tell us a little bit about that.
In those days, Hewlett-Packard was a company that made the tools for other engineers to use. So as an engineer, you were designing the tools for engineers like yourself to use. I worked in the handheld calculator division. We had revolutionized the world with the first handheld calculator that did things like square roots that scientists and engineers needed. And, we were just the star division of the company. We had a lot of time, great camaraderie among the other engineers. But this was a company that so made you respected as an engineer. I decided I'd be an engineer for life, didn't want to move up into management. I just wanted to design good hardware, write good software, you know, make neat new products for people, and this was a great place to do it. And now on the side, not with Hewlett-Packard, I still loved electronics. And I was such a nerd, I'd probably never, you know, have a girlfriend or a wife, so I just did electronics at night. And I got involved in some of the most amazing things that were revolutionizing the world. The earliest hotel movie systems, before any hotel had one, had any movies in the rooms. I was working on them. I got to work on early VCRs before Betamax was even out. The first consumer one was called Cartervision. I saw a Pong game in a bowling alley, and I said, I can't afford one, but I want it, and I can build one. I'm smart enough to build one. I built my own Pong, and eventually Steve Jobs worked at Atari, and they wanted to hire me. I said, nope, Hewlett-Packard's too good a company. But they gave us a job once, and we designed Breakout. I designed it, and Steve helped breadboard it and put it together. And one thing kept leading to another in my life. You know, then I wanted to build that little terminal that talked to computers on the ARPANET. And then the Homebrew Computer Club started, and it was all about computers based on microprocessors, and I finally saw that I was going to have that computer I'd wanted my whole life.
Yeah, you had earlier visualized or dreamed of having a computer that was beyond anything that had existed at that time.
Well, not exactly. I had, in early years when I was in high school programming a computer, I had told my dad, someday I'm going to own a little mini computer. It costs as much as a house. I'll live in an apartment. I'm going to own a computer that I can program on my own. But to me, it meant programming it on a real keyboard with a real computer language. And the input and output of computers can cost more than the computer itself, even in those days. That means you would normally buy a teletype machine. You'd type on these big, heavy keys, and it would crank back like a big metal typewriter. And the teletype might cost more than the computer. So that was a big stumbling block. And finally, you know, 1975, I was putting together all the pieces of technology that existed and what the prices were and figured out a formula for doing a complete computer. The other people at that time that were trying to start out with, hey, we can afford a computer, were building these little kits that had so little capability, they were like the cream soda computer I'd built 5 years before. You know, switches that you can dial in ones and zeros and push a button and the ones and zeros go into memory, and it's all these geeky symbols that computers have, and you have to be a technician, a computer technician, to know just how to throw the first switch, even to turn it on. I didn't want that. I want something like a typewriter, a normal, usable thing like our calculators at Hewlett-Packard were.
Join us next time for another Talk Zone Newsmaker interview.